This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices Spotlight Episode 6 was recorded on March 11th, 2021. I'm Eric Townsend. When we had Kyle Bass on Macro Voices and talked about Singapore really becoming the heir apparent to Hong Kong as Hong Kong loses some of its independence from China, Kyle brought up Abex Technologies, a company that both Kyle and I have invested in. And when I asked him about it, he said, look, you really have to get Josh Crum, the CEO of Abex, on your show to talk about all the different dimensions of this. Because as Kyle put it, he said, look, frankly, I invested because they're doing something cool in Singapore with natural gas and because Josh Crum is involved. And frankly, Josh Crum's the only guy who really understands all the dimensions of this in his head. So we're following up on that advice. Joining me now are Josh Crum, CEO of Abex Technologies, and Joe Rea, the Chief Commercial Officer of Abex Exchange, which is the commodity futures exchange owned by Abex Technologies. Gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Eric. Good to be here.
Thanks, Eric. Thanks for having us.
Josh, people know you as ex-Goldman Sachs commodities guru turned fintech entrepreneur, the founder of Gold Bunny, a company that allows people to essentially have a bank account denominated in gold, complete with an ATM card and so forth. That's a kind of a retail-oriented direction. Then somehow you changed direction, and now your next venture is launching what really is a much more substantial and ambitious undertaking, Abex Technologies, which is not just a new commodity exchange, but also a fintech company. And we'll talk about the different dimensions of that. But I want to start with, okay, what's going on in Josh Crum's life? Why this? Why now? Who are the other principals? And what are you really trying to accomplish here with this company?
Thanks, Eric. I guess a big question to lead off with. So maybe I'll start a little bit with my background and like you said, the transition through, you know, the things that we've done to get to this point. So you know, by background, I'm actually a mining engineer. Got to know the commodity markets from, you know, from the upstream side, from project development and design, all the way through corporate development and you know, capitalizing early stage companies with the Lundin Group. I then moved over to Goldman Sachs, where I worked under Jeff Currie as the global head of metals research, and really got to know the trading markets, the commodity exchanges, future exchanges, and how you know, how companies manage their price risk. But that said, you know, my passion is, you know, as an engineer is building things and solving problems. And so when I look out at on the horizon, both from a technology perspective as well as an energy transition perspective, you know, we've got some very large global problems that we're looking at. And really the first iteration of you know, looking at technology as well as commodity markets and how things could be built differently and better, you know, sort of the first iteration was, you know, as you mentioned, the business that I founded with Roy Sabag in Gold Money, which, you know, actually originally was called BitGold. And, you know, this was not a Bitcoin backed by gold, but we were actually very, very early in building some of the back office systems to really establish trust and be able to, you know, settle gold transactions much quicker, you know, physical gold transactions much quicker using blockchain. And so really that was where the journey started, is recognizing where technology can create some real efficiencies in the way we price and trade, you know, physical real things. And that's really where this journey started. However, you know, my background really is much more in an institutional space than retail, building large, you know, buying and selling and building large projects with the Lundin Group, and then eventually, of course, you know, working with, you know, very large commercial clients with Goldman Sachs. And so, you know, the things that were learned and could be applied from what we did in the very early days of, you know, sort of enterprise blockchain at Gold Money is something that we thought could solve even bigger challenges at the global scale in the energy transition and decarbonization efforts, looking at, starting with something like liquefied natural gas. So that's really where this journey all, started and kind of where we're at. One of my other co-founders in this vision and idea was a gentleman named Tom McMahon, who I believe you've had on the Smarter Markets podcast. And Tom was actually, quite involved in a lot of product development at NYMEX. Was actually the chair of the Natural Gas Committee when the Henry Hub futures market was formed and growing that product. And Tom has really introduced a whole relationship network through the old NYMEX, which is another sort of core part of our team.
Joe Rea, you have been involved in the futures markets for more years than most people want to admit to being alive. It seems to me, as a futures trader, boy, there has been a trend in the industry of consolidation, where CME Group and ICE bought up all of the independent commodity exchanges. Why now? Why Singapore? And why a new commodity exchange when it seems like you're kind of fighting a headwind of, as some would say, consolidation, I would say monopolization of this industry by two big players that are pretty formidable opponents?
That's correct, Eric. And again, thanks for having us. Really the genesis of the idea around ABAX and the ABAX exchange centered around the interest from the marketplace in looking at new ideas in physical commodities. The incumbent exchanges generally are more focused on financially settled products, which is nothing wrong with that. There's a lot more ability to bring those contracts to market faster. However, the genesis of any financially settled contract is in the physical markets. And my background, and maybe I can go into that a little bit, but my background is in physical commodity markets. I went to the Merchant Marine Academy. I sailed on oil tankers for many years. So my genesis of my career is literally in physical oil. And then I went to work for the NYMEX under Vinny Viola for many years, building new markets there for him, particularly after Enron defaulted and the market was looking for better ways to manage risk and mitigate risk with counterparties. And so we developed new products at the NYMEX under the Clearport product banner and really allowed new participants in the marketplace and engage with new participants in the marketplace to bring better ways to risk manage their positions on the exchange. The real importance of what we're doing that's a little bit different is that we are engaging with the commercial players in the marketplace. We are engaging with the firms that are trading the physical commodities and have exposure to risk in the physical commodity markets that allow us to, we see, bring this new exchange to marketplace. Now, granted, to your point, there are a lot of, there is competition from the incumbents, but we think that particularly where we're domiciled in Singapore and how the Asian marketplace has grown, we know that origination of trades from Asia is growing in quite a quick pace, and particularly in gas markets. And we feel that there is an opportunity to bring a new exchange, not only to the marketplace, but with a focus on Asia, at least from our regulatory perspective, that can bring the opportunity for participants to hedge their risk in this new marketplace.
With respect to domiciling in Singapore, it's a pretty easy strategy to understand. Kyle Bass told our listeners when he was on the show that Singapore is very likely to replace Hong Kong as the center of finance in Asia because of Hong Kong's loss of independence. And at the same time, Singapore is already, I would say, the primary energy trading hub in Asia already. So the idea of doing something in Singapore with a new commodities exchange makes perfect sense. Doing something with energy makes perfect sense. What was not clear to me in the beginning as I first started learning about this company was just how strategic liquefied natural gas is to the green energy revolution. Because a lot of people would tell you, look, natural gas, that's another fossil fuel. It's on the way out, just like internal combustion engines and all that stuff. It's going the way of electric vehicles, and we're not going to need fossil fuels anymore someday. But actually, people who really understand how this green revolution is likely to play out see natural gas and liquefied natural gas particularly as playing a strategic role. Help our listeners understand why that's important and why natural gas is an important commodity in this day and age.
Yeah, you have to take a couple of steps back. So if you look at the two answers to your question, first of all, taking a step back and looking at Asia and Singapore in particular, if you look back and over the years that I was at the NYMEX and then the CME, we looked at various regions for domiciling new exchanges. the general consensus was internally, and I think it was in the marketplace, that Asia and Singapore in particular was an important part of the marketplace, but the origination, I like to talk about origination a lot, the origination of trades really wasn't happening in Singapore during Asian market hours. It was generally waiting for London markets to open at the very least, and then obviously when the U.S. markets opened in commodities, the trades would happen. Over the past 3 to 5 years, at the most 5 years, you're starting to see a couple of things happening. You've seen firms move into Singapore that are trading firms, some from mainland China, some from India, some from Europe, some from the US, that are moving to Singapore in particular to set up actual origination trading shops. What does that mean? So during Asian hours now, you are having firms putting on trades, looking at markets, looking at natural gas markets, oil markets, crude oil markets, refined product markets, carbon markets, to hedge their risk and see where opportunities are to trade in those marketplaces. So that's really what's happened recently in the very recent times that made it not only important for the marketplace, but for us to look at Singapore as a place to domicile our exchange. The other point and answer to your question on gas, on global gas, the global gas markets, along with that change in the origination from Asia, is also changing from the destination from a lot of the excess global gas that's on the marketplace. For years and years, projects that were started in, say, Asia, Australia for natural gas fields generally had a long-term life to their projects. So a firm would develop a field in Malaysia, they would build LNG carriers for this, they would transport the gas basically on a floating pipeline between Malaysia and Japan or China or somewhere in the region. And that contract lasted for well over 20 years. Two things are happening over the past couple of the 3 years. The term contracts are coming to expiration, and there's been a lot of excess global gas now on the marketplace, particularly from the U.S., coming from West Texas and other regions. And the destination for that gas is now generally Asia. So when you see the opportunities for firms, not only in the U.S., but also in global markets to trade, you do see, again, the origination of global gas trading happening from the Asian region. And, you know, just to take it a further step, when you look at the focus on carbon and environmental markets, all you have to do is look at what happened in Europe and in the U.S. over the past, say, 5 years. Coal to gas switching from power generation, which is generally the biggest emitter of carbon and pollution in the atmosphere, is generally the biggest, one of the biggest places where carbon reduction needs to happen. We've seen a massive change in Europe, a massive change in the U.S. in generation of power from coal and other more polluting hydrocarbons into natural gas. Natural gas is not just a transition fuel, it is a fuel of the future because it is cleaner and it obviously has less carbon footprint than other fuels. And to take it to the final step, Asia now also, and especially with China announcing their commitment to carbon reduction, you're seeing the adoption of natural gas in China and Asia in general as another stepping stone to carbon reduction and potentially even to hydrogen generation, right? Natural gas and hydrocarbons still need, or power needs to be a part of hydrogen generation, whether it's green hydrogen or blue hydrogen. Natural gas is generally looked at as one of the solutions for the generation and the stepping stone to really clean fuel burning.
Yeah, Eric, and I'd probably add one point. I mean, that was a great explanation from Joe. But when we look at emissions in general from industrial activity, right now there's obviously a very very high focus on carbon emissions and greenhouse gas emissions, including methane, which is an even more potent greenhouse gas. But we also have to remember that over the last, you know, probably, you know, 30, 40 years, but really the last 10, 15 years intensively, the world has gone on a process of really outsourcing, you know, heavy industrial production to Asia and particularly China. So we hear a lot about the labor conversations and currency conversations of cheaper labor, but ultimately, you know, one of the biggest economic revolutions was really the growth of, you know, basically industrial coal and the electrification of China. And so when we think about emissions and having clean air and clean water, you know, natural gas was always a premium fuel for many, many decades. What's changed over the last 5-10 years is not just the demand for cleaner sources of energy, but also the cost base of producing natural gas at scale. And so first you saw natural gas become cheaper than heavy petroleum based products, and then it became cheaper than coal. And now it's not only the cleanest, but it's also the cheapest. And then the other aspect of that's so important about natural gas is it really allows much more grid flexibility to be able to introduce things like solar and wind, which is a big part of the green energy revolution. So when you build very large centralized power grids based around local coal, you do that to try to keep that air pollution out of the big cities. But with natural gas, you can be much more flexible in your hydrocarbon base and your load balance, versus things like solar and wind. So now we believe that the focus on upstream, methane leaks and trying to get rid of hydrocarbons overall is something that looks like society is really starting to capitalize. But that said, there are other aspects than just the carbon emissions that we're trying to reduce to try to clean up the global environment, particularly in China and Southeast Asia.
I want to just insert a quick primer on how energy is traded for any of our listeners who are not energy traders. For something like crude oil, there's hundreds and hundreds of different grades of crude oil that are traded separately. But the way we do all of this is through something we call benchmark contracts. There's just a very small number of contracts that set the prices. Everything else is just priced as a discount or a premium to one of those benchmarks. So in the crude oil market, there are three important benchmarks that really define the entire global energy market. The Brent contract sets the price for seaborne crude oil on ships. The WTI or West Texas Intermediate crude oil contract on the NYMEX is basically the de facto standard for U.S. domestic crude oil. And then there's a Dubai contract for Middle Eastern oil. Everything else is priced off of those contracts. Now, for something like natural gas, we do have a Henry Hub contract in the United States, but that's for pipelined natural gas and really, in many ways, liquefied natural gas that can be seaborne and carried on a ship is almost a different commodity. So when I first learned about what you guys were doing, my first question is, okay, who are you going to be competing with? And particularly, who has the benchmark contract for seaborne liquefied natural gas? Because once somebody's got one of these benchmark contracts, it's kind of a monopoly. It's hard to take it away from them. And I was shocked when I learned there really is none. How is that even possible? I see these ships coming in and out of ports all the time. They're very distinctive ships that carry natural gas. They have to be designed specifically for the purpose. How is it possible that we've got a global trade of liquefied natural gas and there is no benchmark contract for that commodity for everyone to price independent, local grades based on that? How could that even be?
Well, I think the explanation of that, Eric, goes back to my description of the marketplace and how the marketplace in global gas has really evolved, right? From that term contract structure to arguably within the past 2 to 3 years, to more of a short-term or spot market. So there really wasn't a need for hedging in the global gas market up to a couple of years ago because of the use of term contracts for most of the gas that was on the water. Any instrument that was used for any excess gas that was being traded were generally very inefficient means like Brent crude. You talk about Brent. Brent's an oil contract. Brent was used as a hedge. It still is in some contracts that are done between suppliers and receivers in LNG for hedging or pricing the actual molecule that lands up in Asia. And so, certainly an inefficient pricing mechanism. The market moved to Henry Hub to some extent. Again, a very inefficient marker to price against LNG. The market then went to a product called JCC, the Japanese crude cocktail. Again, very inefficient, still being used today. So my point is that there wasn't a real demand for or need for hedging with a benchmark for LNG, and B, the any products that were being hedged were used on very, very inefficient means. And so the marketplace and the opportunity for us is looking for opportunities to list contracts that could bring more direct correlation and convergence to the physical marketplace with the use of a physical futures contract.
Joe, tell me more about what you guys are doing in terms of creating a futures contract seems to me like this is an incredibly ripe opportunity to establish what could become similar to the Brent contract in crude oil, you know, the global benchmark that everybody uses to price seaborne liquefied natural gas. Do I have that right? And what do you guys have in mind?
Well, again, when you look at commodity futures markets, the genesis of any commodity futures markets that's been in existence for many, many years has generally been in physical markets and physically settled markets. I mean, if you look at the contracts that were on the NYMEX or the CME or the CBOT for hundreds of years, basically, going back to New York when they were sitting on the sidewalks and trading them, they were all physically delivered the optionality of physical delivery and physical settlement. I mean, in actuality, most of the contracts that are physical futures don't go to physical delivery, but that optionality gives buyers and sellers of in that marketplace the opportunity to be to go to the exchange to be the buyer and seller of last resort. And what does that mean? If you have a contract, you're holding a contract, you're long physically settled crude contract or a natural gas contract, you can actually, if nobody wants to, if you can't find a buyer of that contract in the marketplace, you can utilize the exchange mechanism to go to delivery of that contract. And that just allows for firms to hold that contract to delivery and utilize that optionality and not have to, you know, sell at a lower price or find a buyer or a seller in the OTC market that's, you know, asking them to deliver at a, you know, not a favorable place. And so that's really what the exchange mechanism does. It allows for price discovery and allows for that buyer and seller of last resort. And again, as I said earlier on, exchanges have gotten away from that. It's easier to launch financially settled products. There isn't the mechanism of going to the regulatory bodies to get approval for them, which is quite lengthy and laborious. There also isn't the need to go to the marketplace to get specifics around the specs of a contract and the quality of particular commodities that you're listing for physical delivery. It's a much easier process. You actually rely on an index provider to actually go out to the marketplace and find and survey the marketplace for prices. So it's a lot different than physical. The financially settled markets are a lot different than the physically settled markets.
Now, what we're talking about so far is a new commodity futures exchange in Singapore, which is going to introduce a very strategic futures contract that could become the benchmark contract for pricing seaborne liquefied natural gas. I love the story so far, but I can't help but think back to when I had Jeff Curry, who heads up commodities research for Goldman Sachs, on the Smarter Markets podcast, and he said, look, Eric, the single most important thing that we need to do as an industry is figure out how to put a price not on natural gas, but on carbon emissions. And if we can figure out how to do that, it's going to be the key to solving the whole green energy challenge that the world faces. What are you guys doing in terms of carbon trading? Have you thought about that marketplace as well?
Yeah, Eric, it's a great question, and certainly, you know, having worked for Jeff for a number of years, you know, really got to know the thinking and the ability for him to really, you know, see ahead, and I totally agree with him. And this is something that I think that you know, as you had a, you know, the conversation with Bill Pezos on Smarter Markets, you know, which was an excellent conversation about the history and evolution of carbon markets. I think what we saw over the last, particularly over the last, you know, 6 months, even within the LNG traders, is how important the link between LNG and voluntary, you know, global carbon markets really is. Really, I'd say the biggest change in this market really came last fall when, well, there was two things that happened. One, there was sort of a long-term offtake agreement from a U.S. LNG exporter into a European utility, where the French government essentially vetoed that long-term contract, you know, based on global emissions goals. You know, that was a very, very important event that happened in global gas markets. And then the second one is when China formally committed to a 2060 decarbonization or you know, carbon neutrality goal, which was really, I mean, really the largest, you know, two industrial, you know, economies, being the U.S. and China. The world was really looking for leadership between these two economies. And so really when you, you know, particularly that second event, what you saw is really the floodgates open for energy traders to really look how we actually organize a voluntary carbon market to start meeting some of the goals of local governments that are taking taking place. And so you know, what we saw, you know, again, talking to industry, is that LNG was really, and LNG trading was really at the forefront of thinking about how we actually create carbon neutrality, and what, at the end of the day, is actually a very clean and pure commodity in LNG. So if you look at LNG as a commodity, it's actually much more homogeneous than, say, you know, crude oil, with all its different, you know, grades and qualities and various specs. So this is really a very clean market to start working on carbon pricing. And so, you know, I'll kind of leave it up there at that, because we don't want to get into the sort of the specific proprietary, you know, approach that we're taking, but just say that we've had, you know, very, very strong commercial interest in what we're doing, how we're doing it, and how these two commodities really go together for setting a price on global carbon.
I'll take that as a signal that you don't want to fully answer the question, because I know you've at least made a strategic investment in Air Carbon Exchange and have some big plans there. It sounds like we're not ready to talk about those quite yet. Let's move on then and talk about, you know, everything we've discussed so far is basically new commodity futures exchange domiciled in Singapore, trading liquefied natural gas, doing some exciting things with carbon credit trading that you're not ready to talk about publicly yet. That's how you're going to make money with this business initially. But longer term, you've got some really exciting strategic plans to not just have another commodities exchange like the other commodities exchanges, but eventually to kind of re-architect the way commodity futures trading actually works around tokenization, what some people call blockchain technology, the idea of digital bearer instruments that provide a whole new way of doing business in finance. Josh, what's the vision? Why would you pick commodity markets as something to apply distributed ledger technology to? And what's your vision of where this is all headed?
Great. No, it's a great question. And again, I sort of go back to my background as both, you know, somebody that's grown up in the commodity industries as well as an engineer, you know, just fascinated by new technologies and new systems and how things work. And so, you know, really being kind of quite early in the blockchain, you know, movement, getting involved and sort of building my first business around this new technology and sort of the revolutionary, you know, work of Satoshi Nakamoto is really the, you know, solving the double spend problem on the internet. Up until now, we've had a, you know, what I call a copy and paste internet, where we've taken, you know, generally paper systems and digitized the speed and movement of various, you know, paper-based information, but really haven't gotten away from all of the trust systems and legal and trust mechanisms that the real world uses to solve these double spend problems in commercial industry. So when we look at the commodities markets, what's very fascinating, and of course, the, you know, the very first comparison of Bitcoin and really based on the work of Nick Szabo of BitGold was this idea to have sort of a scarce bearer asset that can be moved, you know, an actual bearer commodity that can be moved over the internet. So there's always been this link to commodity markets and sort of the, you know, the thinking behind a decentralized computing and blockchain. But being a commodities person as well as a technology person, you know, where I saw that link, you know, was very, very important is at the end of the day, most of these paper-based systems are based on local regulatory and local laws and local regimes. But in the commodities markets, by nature, most of these commodities are global markets. So how, you know, how we deal with having a bearer receipt, you know, shipping across the world, you know, a cargo of commodities and the financing of that digital receipt is something that the commodities markets has always had to deal with. So I've always believed, you know, from the first time I read the white paper, is that this is going to be most applicable in commodity markets. And so really, you know, thinking about, okay, so how do we get from point A to point B? In my view, you know, most of these, you know, people jump to that conclusion very, very quickly. You know, I'm not the only one to make that jump or make that leap. But this is a very, very big system to rebuild and re-architect. And so for, you know, from an ABEX business perspective, you know, kind of knew we needed to be in this game. We knew there's a lot of smart people working in this area, but how do you, you know, these technology cycles, you know, after a revolutionary idea tend to be, you know, we overestimate the impact in the short term or, you know, first 5 years and under-recognize the impact on a 10 to 15 years of these revolutionary ideas. So we wanted to be in the game and we wanted to sort of stake our claim and really build a business almost like an exploration company where you're really focused on long-term research and development, but also have a commercial opportunity to be able to play that long game. So we knew that we didn't want to just build technology and try to sell it to an existing exchange. We wanted to have that technology in the front office, so to speak. We wanted that technology to be a big differentiator in what we do, but also have a sort of a more traditional commercial opportunity to allow us to you know, stay in the game in over the long term, as we knew, you know, it's going to take a long time to build out this infrastructure until we truly have digital bearer assets moved around the world, you know, at the wholesale level of the economy.
And I'll just add to that from my perspective, there's a bridge aspect to this, at least as an investor. This is what I looked at most closely before investing in Abaxx, is there's lots and lots of other guys, Josh, that have seen what you and I have seen, which is we all know that the future of all financial markets is going to move to what people are now calling DeFi, decentralized finance. There's lots and lots of other guys that are trying to figure out how to trade commodities using blockchains. It's all over the place. But you guys are the only one that have veteran builders of existing futures exchanges who are connected in the marketplace to the network of futures commission merchants and commercial traders and so forth, that can put yourselves in a position to be the ones to introduce a distributed ledger-based, or what some people call blockchain-based, version of commodity trading. I think you're extremely well poised to do that. Where there's lots of other people thinking about it, they're not people that were involved in building NYMEX and know all of the players in the industry the way that you guys do. So I think you're onto something. So am I correct, Josh, that the strategy is basically build the futures exchange using existing technology to get it launched, and then in the second generation, you'll start to re-engineer the way it works to embrace digital bearer assets, starting with the warehouse receipts that we've talked about before with Tom McMahon on the Smarter Markets podcast, and begin to essentially do a transition of that futures exchange from traditional technology to DeFi technology?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. But I'd say more specifically what we're focused on is really finding where does this technology at its core, and when I say that technology, I mean true decentralized computing, a true decentralized data store, not a partially, you know, sort of federated database or something that's still centrally controlled, but maybe a little bit less controlled than, say, you know, one server, one company. But what are the real advantages of a true decentralized ledger, and where are the pieces of this very vast ecosystem that we can, you know, kind of be first in sort of solving an actual commercial need. So that's the way we approached it. And so, you know, if you look at the regulatory regime, all of the decentralized trust mechanisms that the global financial system has already built, you know, there's a tendency for technologists to really simplify, you know, what happens on a bank ledger or in a clearing, you know, a central clearinghouse ledger. These are actually mechanisms of federated trust that took really many, many decades and many, many financial frauds and crises to really work out. And all of the separations and powers and separation of liability between, you know, between trading and clearing and settlement and custody and all of these different pieces are already sort of a human paper blockchain, right? It's all the ways that we distribute trust and liability throughout the ecosystem. So there's, you know, based on, you know, sort of the Web 2 sort of cloud computing, you know, business model that we're seeing in information technology and less valuable data, you know, there's this view that, okay, if we can get everybody on the same blockchain or get us, you know, everybody on the same system, that somehow, you know, we're going to create all sorts of efficiencies in markets. But that's, you know, I actually believe that this much more decentralized market is far more efficient than any sort of one technology company can try to understand. So what we're trying to do is looking at how do you actually speed up the settlement of these systems of federated trust. And that's the piece that I think, you know, we're taking an approach of which pieces are going to remain centralized for the foreseeable future, whether for, you know, IT reasons, regulatory reasons, you know, dominant market participant reasons. You know, there are going to be aspects of the system that remains centralized as other pieces of it become decentralized. So, you know, the notion that we've run all these experiments in retail trading and Bitcoin and crypto and DeFi at the retail level, you know, that's very different than moving trillions of dollars through the global economy, you know, particularly in energy and commodity trades. So, you know, our view is there's going to be incremental pieces of this, you know, already global federated system that you can kind of pick off first. And that's really been our approach, is that, like you said, build this bridge where we really understand these pieces of the system, and we slowly introduce the technology throughout the system through the control of our own infrastructure.
Josh, I'm going to invoke Kyle Bass's vocabulary of dimensions of Abaxx Technologies. The first dimension is building and launching a new commodity futures exchange in Singapore, which is going to focus, at least initially, on liquefied natural gas, which potentially could become a global benchmark contract because there isn't one yet, and doing some exciting things with carbon that it sounds like you're not quite ready to talk about. Then the second dimension of Abaxx is re-architecting the way commodity futures trading works to embrace decentralized finance concepts and do some exciting things there. That's more of a longer-term vision thing. There's also a third dimension to Abaxx Technologies. And just to explain to our listeners, the reason it's taken us so long after Kyle Bass suggested this Dimensions of Abaxx podcast to actually do it is because the company wasn't really ready to talk publicly about that third dimension until now. So, Josh, let's move on to ID++. And I want to refer our listeners to an article on CoinDesk. If you Google CoinDesk Self-Sovereign Identity Explained, there's an excellent article explaining this concept of self-sovereign identity. Very briefly, this is the idea, you know, the way you can log into to Google today just once. And when you go to Gmail, you've got your email. You go to YouTube, and if you're a premium subscriber to YouTube, it knows who you are. You don't have to log in again because you've got like a master login to all of Google's different products, but it's only across Google. It's not across everything. It would be so much better if you could be logged in once to the whole internet across everything. And that's an idea that people in the technology space are starting to call self-sovereign identity. Josh, you've got some really exciting plans for how Abaxx can be a pioneer in the area of introducing this self-sovereign identity concept to the finance industry. Tell us more.
Yeah, Eric. So maybe stepping back for a second, didn't Mark Zuckerberg already solve this with Facebook? Wasn't that the pitch to Wall Street back in 2010 that we're going to have one identity on the internet and it's going to be Facebook? I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think this identity issue on the internet, you know, there's nothing new about trying to solve this identity internet. But where I look at it from a business perspective is really the different stages of how different computing models and computing innovation was really able to open up, you know, whole new ways of business. And I will get back to the internet identity piece because I really believe that decentralized data stores, you know, i.e. the, you know, decentralized computing of the blockchain combined with a very strong identity internet will create a strong data internet and really revolutionize the world, very much like, you know, cloud computing plus mobile or maybe the, you know, the GUI and PC revolution before that. And so you know, we're building up from that you know, sort of commoditization of personal computing into the next sort of decade and a half of the commoditization of these networks through mobile and cloud. And where I see the world heading over the next 5-10 years is another sort of game changer, and that's the, you know, having a strong identity internet, like truly decentralized, not identity custodians like like Google, like Microsoft, you know, all of the different ways that you can log into a certain thing using credentials from, you know, from one of these big cloud providers, but truly having decentralized identity really opens up entirely new business models. And I would even, you know, you know, putting on my technologies hat, I actually think it really completely changes the way we do business overall. So you know, getting back to the point that you made earlier about, you know, having paper identity documents, you know, whether it's on a commodity trade or any other sort of contract, our view is that when we get to the point where sort of in a court of law, you know, locally or even in sort of, you know, the sort of new international, you know, legal systems that are forming around blockchain, when you're in a court of law and it's more likely that your digital signature came from the real person than, you know, a handwriting expert, you know, analyzing your squigglies and comparing sort of paper-based signatures, when we get to the point where that digital signature becomes a stronger proof and representation of a real person, then the internet moves to a whole nother level. And so we've been really focused on that problem. You know, the first problem we were trying to solve when we first saw, you know, the blockchain, you know, revolution start to take hold in sort of 2014, 2015, the first piece that I really wanted to roll up my sleeves and get in the weeds of was custody, and started in the gold business, you know, looking at both physical and digital custody and all of the legal systems that surround that. And I wouldn't say custody is yet solved. That's actually still a big problem, even though that's you know, often dismissed. Somehow we've solved this with, you know, with Coinbase custody or you know, some of the trusts, you know, New York chartered trusts that are now getting into digital asset custody. In my view, that private key custody issue is not yet solved, but, you know, we made a lot of progress there. The next stage that I believe that really open up this whole industry is really solving that decentralized identity issue. So that's what ID++ is all about. And going back to my point earlier about, you know, trying to find where are the real, you know, game changers in technology and where can they best be applied within this, you know, very complex ecosystem. That's where we're taking ID++ and actually, you know, looking at what problems can we solve with this technology.
Just to bring this into concrete terms for our listeners, Josh, I want to talk about the DocuSign service, which is extremely, extremely popular in finance. And what DocuSign does for you is it gives you the online equivalent of a signature. In other words, I can go and forge your signature. I can say on DocuSign, I'm Josh Crum, and sign and so forth. They've organized things so that I will probably be committing a crime if I do that, but I could still get away with it. If what you're saying, and I know that you are saying this, Josh, but I just want to put it in context, is if Abex can deliver something like DocuSign that's not a signature, but it's more like a notarized signature where an independent third-party authority is attesting to the identity of the person signing and saying, this really is Josh Crum. It can't be forged. You can't just go sign somebody else's name because you have to be logged in and have authenticated with some kind of two-factor authentication as truly being Josh Crum before you can gain access to sign something. That by itself makes DocuSign obsolete overnight and puts you guys in the position of having a business line just right there that might be bigger than the whole futures exchange business. I mean, this is a really big aspect of this. What's the time frame? Is this just something you guys are thinking about someday, or is this years off, months off? When do we start seeing Abex actually releasing products from this ID++ aspect of your business model?
No, Eric, that's exactly right. We've taken the approach of all of the tools and efficiencies, again, I've called it, you know, Web 2, you know, whether you're looking at something like, you know, decentralized cloud storage, you know, Dropbox, you know, Google Drive, these types of services, but also, you know, Slack, Zoom, DocuSign, as you mentioned, all of these sort of work productivity tools. And we've been, you know, building them on a Web3 architecture, which again is, you know, involves decentralized data stores and decentralized identity. And so really, rather than having, you know, Dropbox is a great service, but it's a great service within Dropbox. You know, maybe they'll open up an API to allow you to connect to some other cloud service, but there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of friction in that, and a lot of, you know, again, it's still fundamentally built on this sort of copy and paste internet. So what we're building is these services and this infrastructure where, you know, you can be as secure as a local encrypted server that's needed, call it web one, that's still used in the banking system and healthcare and other places where you have very strong, important data. You know, so it can be as strong as that, but it can be as flexible and movable as a cloud infrastructure service. So to get back to your question, we've built all of these services already. You know, we have our MVPs of our Web3 version of, you know, Box, of Slack, of Zoom, of DocuSign, and some other tools and services. And our first way that we're going to be rolling out these products is to allow them to be exclusively used by the members of the exchange and to solve, you know, very specific issues that are needed in the exchange marketplace and the global commodity trading marketplace. Just like there's a big problem with the centralization of data and communications in, you know, call it the retail internet with, you know, the Facebooks and the Googles of the world. If you talk to any commodity trader, there's some real problems in this sort of centralization and monopolization of chat apps, you know, of, you know, the movement and control of your own data that you produce financially. We're having these same problems based on that highly centralized version of Web 2, where it's very scalable. It can move very quick. It can form very big oligopolies or monopolies overnight, but ultimately it creates some real problems in the data and transparency and the competition of marketplaces. So we believe that starting with, you know, in the financial services rather than in retail, you know, sort of consumer applications, we believe we can start introducing these new tools of trust in industries that are highly regulated and really, really rely on trusted IT systems. So getting that sort of trust branding by working in a very highly regulated industry, we can then sort of test and prove out our technology and move it into other domains. So that's really the way we're thinking about it. But again, it all comes back to this architecture of decentralized identity and utilizing decentralized data stores.
Well, and I think the opportunity is incredibly ripe for you to establish yourselves as the de facto finance industry identity token of choice. You know, if you look at the way people deal with this problem today in finance, we're really pretty darn stone aged. People literally say, well, the way you prove that you're a finance professional is send me a note on Bloomberg, because we assume since Bloomberg is so overpriced that nobody who's not actually in the industry would ever have one. And therefore, we're going to use that as a validation tool to see if you're a professional or not. That's pretty darned inefficient and crazy. If you can introduce a notarized form of DocuSign that becomes the standard for all contracts in finance, and everybody can execute online documents very quickly, and they have the same effect as a notarized contract, that is a breakthrough. That is tremendous by itself. I want to come back to Joe now, because Joe, it's great you've got a CEO who's thinking about all of these amazing strategic opportunities, but you and I both know if you guys are going to make money in the commodity trading business, you got to have somebody in the team who wakes up in the morning thinking about the commodity exchange, the commodity futures exchange, and nothing but the commodity futures exchange, and is really boots on the ground building it and making it happen. And I would say that based on what you're undertaking, that somebody better be somebody who's actually done this before and has experience building a commodity futures exchange that actually got used. That's where I'm most excited about this company. You don't just have one of those somebodies. You've got several people who were involved in designing and architecting some of the biggest exchanges that are in use today. Tell us who the team is on your side of the house, not the technology long-term strategic side, but right now building the commodity exchange. Who's in charge of this and what are their qualifications and credentials?
Yeah, it's a great question, Eric. And, you know, it is. I always look at the things that I built in my career. And again, most of it in the commodity markets and in the futures markets. And it's always really, you're only as good as the team that you're with and making sure that everybody is rowing, not to use a sailing analogy, but I will, everybody rowing in the same direction. And I think that, you know, I'm very fortunate to be part of a team that does wake up every day to see how we are going to launch this, how we're going to put our collective experiences together from arguably over 100 years of experience in the exchange landscape to build something that's not only traditional, but also something that's better. The futures marketplace and the participants in the futures marketplace, and I look at those participants being not only the trading firms, but the FCMs, the Futures Commission Merchants, the brokers, the technology people, the back office people that are involved in futures markets, they really are in need of a better solution for their business, better for risk management, better for handling of assets, better for handling of money flow and collateral. And it really is in need of it. And you know, if you look back at, and I spent 7 years at Goldman in their futures group on the clearing side. And if you look at even Goldman as being the leader in clearing, in the clearing space, even there, it's only looked at as a utility, right? The revenues that clearing firms generate from clearing customers, unless you're in the scale of Goldman, it's not large, yet they take on all this risk. And so we look at it as, and I go, you know, not to answer your question in a roundabout way, but the team that we have, we're looking at it as how do we solve these problems for them and make their lives better, right? Make it easier. We're not trying to put anybody out of a job with technology, but we're trying to look at a way to better manage risk at these FCMs, right? The FCMs that handle customer flow and risk are looking for better ways too. And up to this point, there hasn't been almost nothing that's been introduced over the past, in all my years in futures markets, that really has made their lives any better. So that's really what we're looking at. And you know, the team we have from myself, and I look at myself as a, not as a, as the key cog in the whole thing, but you look at Dan McElduff, who's our president, who was a great partner of mine at the NYMEX back in the day when we launched ClearPort, which was arguably has been one of the best solutions for risk management in the commodity markets over the past 20 years. Ryan Ingram, who's our chief risk officer, who's had experience across not only Goldman Sachs, but exchanges in Asia. It's just a great team that really was really trying to solve these problems, not only in a traditional way, but also using new technologies that Josh and his technology teams have brought to the table here.
Well, gentlemen, I think we've talked about all of the strategic dimensions of ABECS that I'm aware of. There's actually one more dimension that puzzles me, Josh. In addition to all these other things that you're doing, ABECS owns a large iron ore deposit in Canada. What gives? Why do you have that?
So just to throw everybody off, no. So really, it really was our approach to our capital structure and how we wanted to fund, you know, very, very big ideas that they're going to take a long time. And so you know, when we looked at the types of markets that fund this type of, you know, not just, you know, 3 to 5 year risk, but the 7 to 15 to 20 year risk, you know, there's really no better markets than the markets that really understand resource investing and the commodity infrastructure that's needed to generate, you know, the kind of cash flows at scale of a resource company. And so, you know, we knew we needed to be in this game sort of, you know, 5, 10, 15 years to really, you know, achieve our vision. And so we started in Canadian capital markets. And it's actually kind of funny how the world sort of, you know, worked the last 12 months. You know, you've seen the SPAC really, you know, take hold in the United States. Well, Canadians have been doing SPACs, you know, basically for forever. You know, what would happen is an exploration or development project would either run out of money, or the market would change, or maybe the team, you know, wasn't viewed by the market as the team that could really invest the billions of dollars in CapEx. And so you'd have these exploration projects sort of go defunct, but you still have this shell that may, you know, still retain some cash. And then, you know, an emerging company will take it over through a reverse takeover and become a public company. So now we're now seeing that in SPACs and sponsored SPACs as an alternative to an IPO. But again, that's actually how Canadian markets have been working for a long, long time. So part of our reverse takeover was a company called New Millennium Iron, which actually has a very substantial iron ore asset in Canada in a very, you know, proven geologic zone, very proven infrastructure zone, you know, the Canadian iron ore belt. But ultimately, the cycle turned on iron ore, and this asset was sort of left stranded. So we acquired the company essentially for the cash and the shell, and as a way to list our company with minimal dilution, but ended up inheriting this asset. And actually, you know, a lot of good shareholders as well. So that's really how we came to own this iron ore asset. And I believe in the long-term optionality of resources in the ground. We've got a team and some of our investors that really understand these markets and these long cycles. So yeah, I mean, you know, we're definitely going to utilize that asset, but it's certainly not part of the near-term story.
And of course, you really lucked out in terms of timing because you did this reverse takeover basically in the summertime in the middle of a pandemic when iron ore prices were bottoming. And now we have what looks like the beginning of a secular inflation cycle and commodity super cycle kicking in. And I think the price of that iron ore deposit must have tripled. But it's basically something you picked up almost by accident. It came with the public company that you acquired for the purpose of providing public trading and access to capital markets. But I want to come back to that one, Josh, because you asked me off the air not to make this an infomercial, but to ask you tough questions as well. And there's a tough question that, frankly, is on a lot of people's minds, which is you've got a very, very exciting business here, one which Kyle Bass said just the futures exchange in Singapore and the natural gas, nothing else. That by itself has him incredibly excited about investing with you. So that business by itself clearly warrants at least a NASDAQ listing, if not a New York Stock Exchange listing. ID++ by itself could easily completely, you know, obsolete DocuSign overnight. And that's a business by itself that probably justifies at least a NASDAQ listing. And meanwhile, you've got plans to completely re-architect around decentralized finance, which anybody who can really see where the future is headed knows that's it. That by itself is a business that easily justifies at least a NASDAQ, if not a big board listing. Yet you went and you began your public trading, not just in Canada, but in this tiny little Neo stock exchange, not even on the TSX exchange. And there's literally, as a result of some of the podcasts we've done, we've got people angry at us that you know, investors in Northern Europe saying, I'm calling every broker I know. I can't get anybody to sell me shares in this exciting company because they went and listed it on a stock exchange that very few people have access to. What's going on here? Why did you list it in Canada and on the NEO exchange rather than on the New York Stock Exchange or NASDAQ?
Yeah, Eric, it's a good question. And, you know, for me, I mean, I think maybe once we went public and maybe some of the visibility through the podcast and the vision that I think probably resonated with more people than maybe I was originally expecting. You know, remember, we were a private company raising, you know, essentially raised, you know, $20 million, you know, sort of unbrokered, just sort of through my own relationships over the last couple of years. And one thing I noticed is it was actually because it was so complex, not complex from a business model perspective, but there's so many moving pieces and so many things we have to get right, you know, to really get to the end game scale that we're looking at. You know, it really has a certain type of investor, right? We aren't the nth, you know, cloud computing service or mining opportunity or blockchain opportunity that, you know, sort of you can fit in a bucket with other things. We know we've got a very long path ahead. So, you know, we were, you know, it was sort of hand-to-hand combat and finding investors that really backed our vision. And so, you know, maybe things took on a little bit more life of its own and more people getting it than maybe we saw in the hand-to-hand combat, you know, sort of era of capital raising. And so, yeah, I mean, we probably weren't so, you know, prepared in some ways to offer a pre-revenue company globally. And so, you know, we really wanted to stay in the home markets that we knew. You know, I've always said, you know, even back in the early valuation days, that Canada is one of the best markets in the world to sort of raise 20 million bucks at a $200 million valuation. You know, that's sort of the sort of path we were on in some of my former companies, both with the Lundin Group and then on my own and my partners previously. And so, you know, we kind of were always, you know, focused around that metric. But, you know, at the same time as well, you know, we know that these, you know, small illiquid companies can also sort of get ahead of themselves with too many eyeballs. And so, you know, for us, you know, we wanted to sort of do this, you know, stage-wise, where we're more liquid than you know, a private VC, you know, investment that sort of trades by appointment and, you know, some of these private company exchanges. You know, so we wanted to have the visibility of and the ability to raise capital in public markets. But, you know, this is still sort of our pre-IPO phase in many ways. You know, this is sort of our pre sort of NASDAQ listing phase. So, you know, once we are producing revenue with the launch of the exchange this summer, then, you know, we will look at the larger listing opportunities. So, yeah, you know, hopefully that helps the thinking a little bit.
Well, you just touched on really where my next question was headed, which is where we stand right now is this is still a pre-revenue company. You haven't launched this exchange yet. I'm excited about it because of the vision, and you've got some really high-profile people, whether it's Kyle Bass or Lucas Lundin or Robert Friedland. You know, your backers are some of the most qualified people in the commodity markets world, universe. So that's all great, but still, we're talking about a pre-revenue company that hasn't actually proven anything yet. What does the time frame look like? What are the major milestones that we can expect, and when can we expect them, particularly launching the Commodity Futures Exchange to where you're actually trading natural gas contracts for real customers as opposed to talking about it, planning it, designing it, and so forth?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's really sort of three aspects of the project. You know, there's the commercial aspect that we've really been at for 3 years and engaging physical market participants and getting our contracts ready for trade. And I'd say, again, we're sort of in the 90th percentile of that work over the last couple of years. There's the technology aspect, you know, not just the forward-looking technologies, but the actual, you know, sort of systems. You know, we've got a partnership with NASDAQ and license a lot of our central limit order book technology and clearinghouse technology through NASDAQ. You know, we're connected to the FISs of the world that sort of connect your exchange to the global trading systems at the various banks and large energy traders. So, you know, we're building traditional infrastructure to be able to, you know, handle this sort of, you know, high frequency institutional market, you know, globally. So that technology is built, and again, sort of at the 90th percentile completion of the project. And then the last piece is the regulatory piece. And this is the piece that was really determined our timeline and our listing and our capitalization needs. So, you know, we went public once we got our exchange approval, principal approval in Singapore last fall. That allowed us to sort of go public and get to that next stage of sort of, you know, more tangible, intangible, but, you know, more you know, value you can hang your hat on. And then the last piece is the clearinghouse license. And at that point, we'll be able to prepare and launch our exchange this summer. So we're working through that last piece. Again, we're taking the long game here. You know, we can't put ourselves in a box because, you know, there's a lot of pieces that go into the risk and preparedness of launching a global clearinghouse. If you look at, you know, just even the things that are needed to get a bank license, you know, essentially what we're building is in some way sort of a global bank license, a clearinghouse license. And that to us also adds, you know, for our investors, that adds another sort of valuation benchmark that we can sort of hang our hat on. You know, we've seen a couple, sort of fully integrated exchange clearinghouses sell over the last couple of years with sort of $100 million plus valuations, mostly for the infrastructure, you know, the technology, the regulatory, the operating team of having those types of licensed entities. So this is sort of our stage-wise de-risking, even though we're pre-revenue, is to get that clearinghouse license, get to the point of launch, you know, have another sort of valuation benchmark, and then the market can start forward looking to the potential revenue of our markets.
Are we going to see a listing on a major stock exchange, let's say NASDAQ or NYSE, by the end of 2021?
Yeah. I mean, again, we don't want to put ourselves in a box, you know, on things that are sort of regulatory out of our control. But yes, I mean, as far as our plan, you know, that is to, you know, get up in trading and sort of prove out our customer base and the need and utility of the products we've been building. And, you know, upon a success, you know, a commercial success of those types of launches, yeah, we would then seek to list in, you know, whether it's the US and NASDAQ or out in Asia, you know, perhaps the Singapore Exchange. And I'll admit, you know, we are much more familiar from a timing perspective with, you know, what it'll take to be NASDAQ, which I think could be within the next year, but, you know, earlier stage discussions for Asia.
Well, I look forward to talking to you again for an update as things continue to progress. But before I let you go, Josh, please tell investors in our audience where they can contact you from an investor relations standpoint. How do they get in contact with the company to find out more?
Well, Eric, we are sort of a digitally native company, so probably the easiest way is to just to go to our website, abex.tech, and go to our investors section and sort of sign up for our updates, as well as the Smarter Markets podcast that we partner with you on. You know, that's another place where you can sign up for various informational updates. You know, we've got a lot of, you know, there's been a lot of different topics we've covered here, and we try to bring in the world's experts to talk through, you know, market structure, energy transition, technology. There's a lot of pieces that we try to bring it, put out long form in these conversations. And then, of course, you can, follow myself on Twitter at Josh Crum. We also, have our company links that in my bio. And then Joe Rea is quite, well followed on LinkedIn. So yeah, I mean, there's a number of places, but, it's in this age, you can generally find us online pretty easily.
Well, gentlemen, thank you for a terrific interview. Listeners, stay tuned for updates coming in the coming year. I'm very excited about where this company is headed. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit macrovoices.com.